the information I need. Okay. So, will you start off by talking about your background?
Sure. I grew up in New York City. My parents were immigrants from Russia, and I was the first member of my family to go to college, as was so often the case. My parents, as is typical with, even stereotypical with most Jewish families, wanted me to be a physician. But from high school on, I was really intrigued with the idea of being a psychologist for some strange reason.
Well, what do you mean, some strange reason?
Well, I've always enjoyed it, but it was a strange idea, certainly for my parents.
They, but do you remember what...
Well, I was intrigued with the idea that I encountered first when doing some reading in high school, that there were laws or principles of human behavior, the notion of regularities, and indeed discoverable principles accounting for human behavior. It was a fascinating idea to me. It just seemed to capture my imagination. And ever since high school, I knew that I wanted to be in the social sciences generally and in psychology in particular.
Was this a special high school?
Well, I did go to a special high school. I went to a high school that concentrated on the sciences, Stuyvesant High School in New York City. But I don't think high school had any particular influence in that decision. As a matter of fact, I think I found the high school quite disappointing. It wasn't as challenging as I would have wanted. It certainly wasn't as advanced. The science I learned, the physical sciences, for example, I learned, was really outmoded even for that particular period. When my daughters went to Memorial High School, they learned far more science than I had acquired in that high school that was supposedly specializing in science. Mm. At any rate, after I came back from the military, which was in 1976, I finished my education on the GI Bill of Rights.
You said 76.
Oh,
76.
And it's all beginning to blur. When I came back from service in 1946, I finished my education at NYU on the GI Bill of Rights. And then in February 1948, went to University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Michigan?
Well, I think primarily because they accepted me. In I did graduate work in psychology. I didn't really know much about Michigan, as a matter of fact, when I went there. I think I was very ill-informed by the advisors at NYU at that time. I went to Michigan because I wanted to get out of New York, because it seemed to be a good department, and primarily because they accepted me for graduate work. I don't think I had all that great a high school record, as a matter of fact. I was just a B-ish student. At any rate, that turned out to have been one of the most fortunate events in my life. It was fortunate from a number of respects. Social psychology was very, very new at that time. And one of the leading places, if not even the leading place for social psychology, it turned out, was at the University of Michigan. They were the dominant influence in the field at the time. And so I was in very, very much on the ground floor. I made contacts there also that turned out to have been very, very helpful. And it was primarily through the my major professor at Michigan, who was Professor Daniel Katz there, that I obtained the job here. Katz was held in very high esteem by people in the psychology department here, they consulted Katz when the department here was looking for a social psychologist, and Katz referred me to that position. So, again, there were all sorts of unplanned events, fortunate events that have shaped my career, and I am firmly convinced that the most important secret for success is being in the right place at the right time.
The interlude with the Air Force, was that because you hadn't expected to go into the academic world?
Well, there were very, very few. I got my PhD in 1951. There were very, very few positions at that time. And I don't even know that I had any particular aspirations for an academic. Well, yes, I did. I did have some aspirations, but I wasn't thinking high. It seemed to me at that time that the kind of life I wanted was to be a professor at a small liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. That was my level of aspiration.
Well, it's a good level.
Yeah, right. I expected to lead
it.
Well, it would have been a very comfortable life. I expected to be, or I thought of myself as being, let's say, just that kind of a teacher. I went to work for the Air Force, primarily because there were no jobs at that time, and did some research for 4 years on the morale of bomber crews. I think one of the things we discovered was that the morale was low because the people didn't want to be in the service. We didn't really come up with any profound discoveries or really even earn our keep very much. At any rate, I was very happy after 4 relatively frustrating years to get the position here at Wisconsin. And I found that I, well, did very well in the atmosphere here. It turned out that I enjoyed doing research. I found that I really got a tremendous kick out of it. Again, it was a matter of discovering the principles regulating human behavior that continued to fascinate me. I got almost a kind of an aesthetic pleasure out of finding some of these regularities. And it turned out that Wisconsin is just the kind of a place for an individual who does enjoy research. There's a lot of support for research, and indeed a lot of reward given to those who enjoy doing research. And so I think my career took off from the time I arrived here, which again was due primarily to accident. The fact that Katz had been contacted by the psychology department here, and he, just 4 years after I obtained my PhD, happened to think of me on that occasion, so he recommended me for the job. Well, what else?
All right. Had you done well in graduate school?
Oh, I thought I was just an average student, actually. Mm-hmm. Michigan wasn't especially challenging. They didn't make much of grades. They did have a doctoral preliminary examination, but didn't make much of it. They more or less assumed that everyone they accepted would complete his PhD. Mm-hmm. It, as I say, wasn't especially challenging.
No,
I don't know that I had any special reputation in graduate school.
There was a letter about your hiring which suggested that you were considered quite a gem to get hold of.
Did you see that? I have never seen any such statement.
Well, maybe I'm putting it a little too strongly, but it was definitely...
Was this something that Katz had written? Do you recall?
No, it was, I think, an inter somebody to a dean. Why we want...
Well, I did get along with Dan Katz, so he might have made a strong statement, or else it might have been even...
No, it was from the department.
Well, yeah. Well, I think when I was interviewed, I displayed, if I remember correctly, a lot of interest in doing research, because that is an essential part of me. And I think that came across, and that's what impressed, I believe, some of the people here.
I guess what I'm trying to find out is what leads to your becoming a violist professor.
I see.
Whether it was to be anticipated then, or...
No. Again, it was accident. It really was... Well, I don't know about accident. It is true that I enjoyed... Oh, there's another... Well, somewhat accident. Let me organize my thoughts. Somewhat accident and somewhat the fact that this is the way I got my pleasures. I really enjoyed doing the research, and above all, I enjoyed writing about it. So that it wasn't any strain for me to spend the entire evening and night writing up the reports of the studies I did. I enjoyed doing lots of studies. The graduate school here provided funds for hiring research assistants. So I did had the wherewithal to do experiments. And as I say, I did not find it any strain at all to spend a lot of hours at night. After the family was asleep, I very often stayed up until about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning writing. And I really enjoyed that. I would have the radio on, listen to the music that was played at that time. Late night music is very different from everything. It's a kind of separate world.
Mm-hmm.
And do my work. So that what happened is that I sort of mounted a good many publications. It was not a strain for me.
Yeah.
And to this day, as a matter of fact, I find it somewhat difficult to empathize with young people who maintain that their responsibilities for their families, their roles as husbands, wives, parents, keep them from doing any publishing. Of course, it seems to me, well, in my own experience, I was able to do that between 9 and 1 or 9 and 2.
And you didn't feel that you had neglected your...
No. I didn't feel that. As a matter of fact, I didn't feel that whatsoever. I, of course, did have a wife who was a very active parent, but I don't think I was totally out of the picture by any means.
And she wasn't aggrieved about it?
No, not at all. No, maybe she wants to get rid of me. But no, she wasn't aggrieved. I really don't believe I neglected family. I just enjoyed working late.
Yeah.
Then another thing that happened is, again, illustrating the role of chance in my career. One of the first topics I taught when I came to Madison, and it was primarily a lucky break. I covered in one of my courses the then available research on aggression. This was a topic that had been largely neglected. There wasn't any particular particular reason why I selected that topic for coverage in my this particular course. It just, again, seemed to intrigue me. So I began teaching this topic. I amassed a bibliography for the purposes of this course. And I then decided, since it seemed to be a relatively neglected area at that time, I decided to do some research. And from the very start, I found that I was getting federal grants to do research in this particular area. Of course, it was a brand new, or a largely new field of research. I also used my lecture notes to write a first a review of the literature, which achieved a certain amount of attention for a journal, and then I published a book all on the basis of my lecture notes. And that book was one of the very first reviews of research on aggression. So I had, in a sense, the very real advantage of being one of the first in that field, on the research in aggression.
Yeah. And it must be the most singularly important field.
It actually has lost a lot of. There was a good deal of interest in research on aggression in the 60s, in the heyday of the urban disorders and so forth. Now it's a very inactive field, except for a few people like myself. Social psychology in general isn't paying a special attention to it. But at any rate, the point is, because I was one of the pioneers, I achieved a certain amount of visibility, and I'm still, I think, widely known. I also got in on the ground floor and doing research on the effects of movie violence and television on aggression. One of the very first to do experimental research in that particular area. It's not because I had any special interest in the question of whether movies or television could have adverse effects, but because it was a logical part of my research program to cover those particular matters.
Well, that's an absolutely fascinating question. Mm-hmm. I'd looked at some of the things you've written. Well, let's. I'll ask you then on the department, how you found it when you got here, and what you know of its earlier history before you got here.
Well, I think the department has always been relatively highly regarded and has always had relatively good people in it. The department, over the years that I've been here, has maintained very much the same kind of culture, even though the personnel have changed, and that's an interesting kind of moment. It's always been very, very empirical. Indeed, I think this is probably true of science at the University of Wisconsin generally. There's a good deal of interest in doing research here. There is a lot of, as I said before, resources available for the conduct of research, and the rewards are given for doing research. So there's always been a great emphasis on a valuing of empirical research. The psychology department is very much in that vein. One of the deficiencies, I think this is especially true in the social sciences, is we don't have any great theoretical innovators, maybe because our reward system rewards people who do lots of research more than it rewards people who are in the theoretical forefront in their particular fields. But at any rate, that's the way the psychology department was. We had a great bunch of empiricists, but no theoreticians, no people who had really contributed a great deal to important theoretical developments. And the department has always been that way. It's not that the people, I should backtrack a little bit and say that that was largely true, but not entirely true. Harry Harlow in my department did indeed make very important theoretical contributions. And I think he is the one exception to this.
Mm-hmm.
When I came, the department, well, I don't know, how much detail do you want me to go into?
You go into detail.
You do want this? Okay. What I would have to do, really, is to talk about the state of American psychology.
Well,
want to get into that?
Yes, since it would be relevant to what the state of psychology was here.
Okay, all right. What are you going to do with all of this? Does anybody... Okay. Now, I think in order to fully understand the psychology department, especially at the time that I came, you have to get a picture of the place of the department within the broader context of American psychology. I think it's fair to say that in the 1950s, the most prestigious field within psychology had to do with the study of learning. And in particular, the most favored ideas were ideas derived from principles of conditioning, classical and operant conditioning. Well, the Midwest was the place where a lot of that learning research was being carried out, and the leading figures in the study of learning were, with some exceptions here and there, seemed to be concentrated in the Midwest. The three most eminent people in the Wisconsin department were also very, very widely known for their research in learning processes.
Who were?
These were Harry Harlow, Wolf Brogdon, mm-hmm. and David Grant. They were very active investigators. They had made some important contributions. And Harry Harlow, in particular, was known not only for his learning-oriented research, but also for the primate studies that he was doing. He was one of the pioneers in psychology in the use of primates as experimental subjects. Well, the department, as I say, had a great deal of prestige, primarily because this was one of the places where important research in learning was carried out, and especially because of the visibility of Harlow, Brogdon, and Grant.
Mm-hmm.
These three people weren't especially interested in social psychology. They knew very little about it. They had learned that in order to have something of a department, something of a departmental prestige, that is, in order not to be seen as being excessively narrow, that they had to cover other topics besides the experimental psychology of learning. And so the department had a small program in clinical psychology, had a very small program in industrial psychology, and they also were interested in having some child development and social psychology as well. In all cases, whatever the particular field, the faculty members in the area were expected to do research, and hopefully a lot of research. The people on the outside, people in other departments around the country, sometimes had the impression that our triumvirate, the dominant influences in the department, were anti anything that was not experimental psychology, not involved in the experimental psychology of learning in particular. And so there was a conception that the department was opposed to clinical psychology, was opposed to the supposedly softer areas within the field. In my experience, that was not the case. From the very beginning, from the time I first came here, I found that the department in general, and those three people in particular, had very much of a live and let live orientation. And I think that remains to today. People go about doing their own things. There's not an awful lot of collaborative research by any means. I'm not even sure that there's a high level of interest in what other people are doing specifically. Not in any general way, at any rate. That is it's not widely characteristic. But what the department valued at that time was somebody who did research, whatever they did, as long as they did it, and seemed to do it well. And as I say, the resources were provided to enable a person who was sufficiently motivated to do his work. So,
I just wanted to say the sources were provided. Are you talking about WARF
graduate
grants?
School? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that was always very important. WARF grants. Research space, however, mm-hmm. as well. But I think the research committee was a very important part of my getting started. Mm-hmm. But also, I might say that from about, I would say, 1957 or 1958, I had federal grants. Mm. So that helped a great deal, too. Well, so I would say that the department generally, and Harlow Grant and Brogdon in particular, were not anti the so-called softer areas, but they wanted people to do work and a lot of empirical research. My own orientation has always been to do laboratory experiments in social psychology, whatever the topics I've been working on, and that also fit in. What the department has done is really favored a experimental or laboratory approach to the study of the various problems, and that was what was generally valued. Well, as the years have gone by, and well, one of the things that has happened is that as the department expanded and as new people came in, and as Harlow, Brogdon, and Grant got older, they inevitably lost their overriding influence. That happened well before people on the outside were aware that these three were no longer the kingpins, longer the movers and shakers. But even though their influence diminished greatly, as I said before, the culture of the department seemed to continue. We continue to place a good deal of value to this day on turning out lots of empirical research. And again, to this day, we're not especially well known for being theoretical innovators.
Did you ever worry about that and say, could we find a theoretical innovator?
Yeah, oh yes. But we don't seem to have been, well, I know a number of departments, as a matter of fact, not only psychology, have attempted to rectify this. For example, the sociology department made a number of efforts to try to get a theoretician.
Well, I suppose Orchid would know.
He was in economics.
Yeah, no, I meant, I know he was economics, but I was wondering if he'd be in attempt to get a theoretician.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it's a generally valid one, that political science. Economics, I think, now does have theoreticians in the form of people who do mathematic models in the field of economics. People like Rothschild, for example. I don't know what, and several others, I understand. So the statements that I'm making here, I'm not sure apply too well to them, but I think with a few possible exceptions, we don't really provide the theoretical innovations at the University of Wisconsin in the social sciences.
Do you think it's a question of salaries, not being able to offer enough salary?
I don't think it's a matter of salaries. Our salaries are not of the highest, but I don't think that that's a principal problem. The sociology department, for example, as I understand it, made offers to several people that were adequate from a salary point of view, but still we weren't able to get the kind of people who are theoreticians or were doing important work. It's difficult to say really why that was. Possibly even our image as a place where numbers counted. Maybe that contributed. I don't know. It's not that the work, the place has always been highly thought of, the psychology department has always been highly regarded, but again, especially as the, let me get back to this business about the leading work was conditioning-oriented research in the field of learning. That changed in the 1960s. In the early 1960s, there became in psychology a rapidly growing interest in what's called cognitive processes throughout all of the different psychological fields. And with that mushrooming growth of interest in cognitive processes, the Wisconsin department fell behind, so to say. And so we're not where it's at in the study of cognitive processes. And that's true for all of the fields within psychology. With it, we do have people who are studying cognitive processes in a variety of ways. We have them in experimental psychology, we have them in clinical psychology, we have them to a certain extent in social psychology, but we're more or less followers instead of being among the innovators, among the leading contributors of new thought. So I think it's fair to say that the Wisconsin department is in real danger of becoming much less highly regarded. Why we haven't been able to get the kind of people, maybe because we've been in some ways too conservative. It's hard to say. It's hard to say. We've been relatively conservative in our hiring policies. We have, in a sense, not taken a good many risks. But I think it's also very, very difficult to predict, and this is another matter. I think this is a very important phenomenon, at least that I'll come to. If you think of some of the leading psychology departments in the country, you have to come up with names such as Stanford or Michigan. These were places that were always very interested in buying, if I may put it that way, established talent. They would pay a lot of money to get people with already established names, people who had proven themselves. We, as a department, and I think perhaps the university in general, has shown much less interest in that kind of a strategy, perhaps partly because of our salary situation. We haven't always had the full coffers that would enable us to go out and spend lots of money for highly regarded people, especially as the salaries exploded in the 1960s.
Yeah. Yes, that's interesting. I've heard that said from other departments, but presented as a positive value of Wisconsin, that it did take young people and that it thought would be promising.
But
I think probably
promising.
Salaries has something to do with it.
Well, it's comfortable. But you see, that's in a sense, when that kind of statement is made, saying that this is characteristic of the place, we only hire people as young assistant professors and bring them up, and in a sense, it indicates that we're not big-time operators.
Well, I mean, they think it's good.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. But I'm saying that point of view illustrates how the university, with some exceptions, is not a place of big-time operators.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It doesn't picture itself the way a Michigan or a Stanford or several other universities do, picture themselves as being in the forefront and willing to do everything possible to get the stars.
Yeah.
We have never, to my knowledge or to my perception, really set out to compete with the Stanfords, the Harvards, the Yales, the Michigans. At least not in psychology.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it would be something that would have to be pursued throughout the university. You couldn't have one department who would say, well, we're really going to get stars. Because then the other departments would say, well, we'd like.
Well, I wonder, I don't know what's done. For example, biochemistry has a very good reputation. I don't know how they've done it, whether it's solely a function of bringing people along or whether they've imported some eminent people. I suspect it's probably the former. But at any rate, I would say that in psychology in general, we have been discriminating in our granting of tenure. We have been one of the departments that has been most selective in not retaining young people who didn't seem to fill the bill. But nevertheless, in our initial hiring, we haven't seemed to really been able to select a lot of stars. There are some exceptions. We have had in the department some people who have proven to have very good reputations, and who now have very good reputations. For example, there's a Michael Posner, Edward Smith, a man named Herschel Leibowitz. But these people have all gone elsewhere.
Oh.
Smith went to Stanford, because Stanford was not only climatically very pleasant, but by the at that time was had a tremendous amount of prestige and was viewed as a place where the theoretical developments were coming from. Mm-hmm. And so Smith wanted to be at a department that seemed to be more in the forefront. It was the scenery was pleasant, the weather was marvelous, and he would have lots of colleagues. So we did hire a few people who have worked out very, very well, but they haven't always stayed here. So, because, so what has happened is that I think that not having a Harlow, Brogdon, or Grant nowadays, the department is, I think, not going to have the national reputation that the psychology department enjoyed in the 1950s.
I noticed it dropped from, I think, 7th to 10th in between 74 and 79.
Oh, is that the case? I didn't know that.
In national ratings.
I guess I haven't seen the 79 figures, or I wouldn't be surprised, but I had thought it was, a little higher. I thought it was about 7, according to some kind
of... Well, 7 was an earlier figure.
I see.
I happened to see that figure. Tell me about the Rogers, Carl Rogers. Was he seen as somebody who'd be in the forefront of...
Oh, indeed. That was an interesting episode. Rogers seemed to be a mover. That is, he migrated a lot from one psychology department to another. He, I think, had grown up in this area.
He went to the university, I think.
And he seemed to have some kind of family ties here. So after he decided to leave, I believe, the University of Chicago, where he hadn't gotten along too well with the other faculty members there, he apparently put out feelers. I was not on the executive committee at that time. I was not altogether sure exactly how it came about. But I understand that he put out feelers indicating that he had an interest in coming to the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The psychology department jumped at that possibility of getting somebody who would have his national, and indeed even international, standing. And also it was seen as a way of rectifying the conception of the Wisconsin department as being anti-clinical psychology. So the arrangements were made. The psychology department, as I understand it, paid his entire salary, but he also had an appointment in the psychiatry department. Mm-hmm. Well, that did not work out. I didn't have all that much contact with Rogers, but my perception, and of course it should be recognized that I've I'm definitely a part of the psychology department's culture. My perception is that while both sides were at fault, that the major part of the blame, I think, has to be placed on Rogers. He gives very much the impression of a person who is open to all ideas, that he's can tolerate all sorts of different approaches. I think that that is entirely wrong. I don't think he's that kind of individual at all. I think the way he acts and what he proclaims are two very different things.
That's bad in a psychologist, isn't it?
It's not widely known about this, but I happen to believe that this is the case. First of all, in the days that Rogers was here, we had the department in its let me explain this. The department in its graduate training has relatively few requirements. It's rather laissez-faire. But we did have a few. I might say that this is, in the 1960s especially, there were many graduate departments of psychology that had all sorts of established curricula, that had all sorts of programs worked out with courses that the graduate students had to take. We had very little of that. Nowadays, as a matter of fact, we have virtually no requirements, with the exception of statistics requirements. But we had a few more in those days, but not much more. Rogers found that even those requirements, to me, rather minimal requirements, were far into what he wanted.
There's a letter from him to Harrington, and that was his complaint. Against the graduate student program, and what he spoke of was constant evaluation of the graduate students.
Yes. Well, I don't think there was constant evaluation. We had a so-called pro-seminar that was required in the first year, which was a course in basic psychology. Mm-hmm. It was divided into sections, and the students took a test at the end of each section. Of course, there were students who didn't do well in this, but very often, in fact, indeed, very often, students who didn't pass a section test were allowed to take it over again. The department has always permitted repetition of exams. Always. We fail out very, very few people. But he didn't like the fact that there were exams in this course. He didn't like the fact that there were exams in our statistics course, which was the other requirement. He didn't believe in advisability of evaluations. I don't agree with him whatsoever. But I think the nub of the thing is not only the evaluations, but the fact that the material being covered was not important to him. He said on at least one occasion that nothing of importance has been learned in American psychology. And so he didn't think that his students really had to learn what was taught in these courses. At one time, on the matter of evaluations, on the one time he thought that the best type of graduate training would be to allow students to come in, that is to select students who you thought had the right characteristics, start the graduate program, and then not do any kind of testing or evaluation for the next 4 years, and then evaluate them only when they are ready to complete their degree. Well, if you do any serious evaluation at the end of 4 years, if you really want to evaluate, it seems to me it would be very cruel to tell some person after that individual's put in 4 or 5 years of graduate work, you're not going to be good enough. It'd be far better to weed out those individuals at the first year rather than the fourth or fifth year. I think that that procedure that Rogers advised would be especially cruel. Let's see, what else was I going to do? Rogers also argued that these constant evaluations, as he saw it, stifled creativity.
Mm.
And I don't think that there's any evidence that that's true. Certainly not to the extent that he maintains. But, you know, I think the principal thing that was involved in Rogers' difficulty with the department is he had some very definite ideas of his own. He had his own philosophy, his own approach. It was not an especially approach that was built on, let's say, the foundations of American psychology. He had his own ideas. I think he was so wedded to those particular ideas that what he wanted were people who would agree with him.
Mm.
And he did not tolerate a divergent approach. If he had wanted, he could have been allowed to do his own thing. But he essentially insisted on having his approach be the department's approach.
Yeah, I see. That's where you had to stop.
Yeah. And also, the students he attracted, frankly, were our least able students.
Did he attract a lot of students?
Oh, he attracted a lot of students. But they were not the best students. That was certainly true among our clinical psychology students.
Mm-hmm.
It was the relative weaklings who went to sit at his feet.
Because he wasn't training them, in fact.
Well, he believed that, at least he believed in those days, that to be a good therapist, the fundamental criterion was that you had to be a good guy. Had to be a nice
positive
person.
Absolute empathy.
Unconditional positive regard.
That's right. I edited his book on this, you know, the schizophrenic study.
Oh yes, the one over
Congruence.
On the window.
Yeah.
So he didn't think that people had to do any technical learning.
Mm.
See, all they had to do was be nice people. And that appealed to the less scientifically oriented. What else was I going to say? I think that there were other kinds of deficiencies, if I may put it that way, in his way of doing things. He was almost in some ways vindictive because of his the divergence. Again, let me say, I think that if a person is willing to play the game, make some accommodations, you can get along. I certainly did not see eye to eye with Brogdon on many issues, but we tolerated each other, and indeed I think even had some respect for each other. But Rogers was unable to do that, to really tolerate a divergent approach. His orientation seemed to be, you either play my way or I'll pick up my marbles and go home. But he did more than that. As I say, There, if my memory serves me right, there were some occasions when he was a little vindictive. For example, on one occasion, there was a preliminary exam that was unduly narrow, unduly rigid, unduly severe. There's no doubt that he was correct in objecting, there's no doubt in my mind that he was correct in objecting to those particular preliminary examination questions. I think that was the thing that prompted it. But whatever was the cause of his dissatisfaction, he came to a department meeting with a tape recorder, which he placed on the table and started. And it went off with his lecture on the evils of the graduate training program. In other words, he wasn't able to say things as freely and as spontaneously
That's fascinating.
Sure, he proclaims the virtues of spontaneity and free expression, but he had to give his talk previously tape recorded. Another thing that he did, this I did see, was that when students wrote to him, prospective students wrote to him, asking if they could come to the University of Wisconsin to work with him, he sometimes wrote back towards the end of his stay here, saying to the students, don't come to Wisconsin. It's a place that stifles creativity, and he would say all sorts of bad things about the place. And then he would circulate the carbons to those letters among all of the members of the faculty. In some ways, I suppose he was being honest, but by circulating the carbons, he was also in a way sticking out his tongue at the other people in the faculty.
It's interesting. He resigned. You might well have liked to have, to have gotten rid of him, I suppose.
Well, we didn't. We certainly didn't see eye to eye. There was no way of getting rid of him.
Yeah.
But as I say, he certainly wasn't willing to accommodate. I think that we're not the only ones who had these difficulties with him. As I say, he has had a history of leaving departments.
Yeah.
But on top of that, my recollection or my understanding is he didn't get along with a lot of the people in the psychiatry department either. There were a few people who were very close to him there, but there were several others who were not at all close to him and not at all in agreement with him. So, that's Rogers.
Yeah, I had two questions. Just one very briefly was the mess that apparently occurred in the research, doing of the research for the study, was that his doing? Yeah.
I don't know very much about
that. All right.
I really don't know. You mean the conflict he had with, what's his name? That young clinical.
Yeah, I had that. There were things having to do with the data and the loss
and
of data.
And they locked it up and the safes and things. I really don't know about that.
And the other thing is...
Kirchhoff, what was the other fellow's name? He was one of Bob Martin's students. Forgotten the guy who committed suicide. Did you know
was there a Lewis in there?
No.
Mm.
Lewis committed suicide. He was a psychiatrist.
Oh, yeah.
No, there was... I don't know about that.
The other thing is it worth talking about him this much in terms of his present reputation? Is he? He has many books out.
Yes. Well, I think he is a person who has an international reputation. He is a person who will loom large in the history of American psychology in the 1960s and early 1970s. I think Rogers is also a person who was very fortunate in being at the right place at the right time. A couple of years ago, there was a review of one of Rogers' books in the New York Times, in the Sunday New York Times, where the reviewer, a psychologist, made what I think is a very valid observation. He said that Rogers' type of theory, his approach to psychotherapy and his approach to the human personality, came along at just the time when the society was in favor of that point of view.
Mm.
And that contributed greatly to his national and international standing. The society, in a sense, was ready for it. The society was interested in encounter groups. The
yeah.
society was interested in self-actualization, in encouraging the individual to do his own thing. If you will, the society was interested in a kind of selfish, narcissistic approach to human behavior. And that's what Rogers' philosophy was. He was there. He was one of the supporters of that societal, that cultural approach, was one of the supporters of it, one of the people contributed importantly to it, and one of the beneficiaries of that kind of approach. If he had come along, let's say, in these days, he would have been given much less attention. And as a matter of fact, he, of course, did establish a reputation in the 1950s. He was developing a fairly good reputation in the 1950s, partly because he was among the first, as I understand it, to do research into the psychotherapy process. But if the orientation of the 1950s had continued, you know, the conservative orientation, the business of having the individual fit in and so forth, I'm not sure at all that Rogers would have the standing that he achieved, actually did achieve in the 1960s and early 1970s. He was in the right place. That is, he came along.
Illustrates your earlier point.
Yeah, right.
Place at the right time.
Well, not only the right place, but he was at the right time.
Yeah.
He, the society was ripe for him, and he was there.
Well, I'd be interested in what you have to say about Brogdon also, and Harlow as other as stars of the department,
yeah.
working with them, what kind of people they were.
Brogdon, can I quit around 11:30?
Yeah.
In fact, I'm even surprised I'm staying this long. I have a desk full of stuff to do.
Do you want to do it some other time?
No, I might as well, as long as I'm here,
all
but
right.
I'd like to stop, however.
Well, we can finish. Oh, no, this tape is almost over. In fact.
See, he was here, Smith was here, came in 48,
mm-hmm.
and so he would not be somebody to talk to.
Oh, I think you might want to talk to him, but what a picture he would paint.
Well, that isn't necessarily very useful.
Well?
That is, if there's no accuracy to it.
It's a question of his interpretation of things in the emphasis. Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting painting there. What?
It's Indonesian.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Can I look?
Sure.
Well, Wolf Brogdon, in my experience, was a very responsible man, a great departmental and university citizen, took his role very, very seriously, and had a very narrow conception of things. Very rigid in his point of view. But he was such a good university and departmental citizen that he was never really destructive. I don't think everyone who has encountered him would have that, would agree with me wholeheartedly in that last point, but I saw him as being an excellent university and departmental citizen. When I came, I think he was at that time an associate dean of the graduate school, as well as being half-time in the psychology department. My understanding is that he was a very rigid enforcer of graduate school rules. I could well expect him to do those kinds of things. He would live up to the letter of the law. He was very close to the then dean of the graduate school, Elvium. When Elvium left the graduate school, Brogdon also left. I don't think that Brogdon would have been kept on because his rigidity, his sticking to the letter type of approach wasn't really widely appreciated. He just rubbed too many other people the wrong way. He had done very important research in conditioning before I came to the department and was still widely known for that research, but his important contributions were largely over by the time I arrived. Nevertheless, he continued active. He maintained a research program, but I don't think anything much was coming out of that. The role he played in the department was a very active one also. He expressed lots of opinions. His opinions were highly predictable. He didn't have much tolerance for a softer approach to psychology. I think it's fair to say that he didn't have much interest in having women in the department, but again, I think primarily because of the, not because he was prejudiced against women in and of themselves, but because he didn't think that, he thought that women would be likely to leave the department if they got married or would go with their husbands. And he didn't think that they would be sufficiently dedicated to the role of being a researcher. So,
when I'm just curious, when is this the possibility of having women being discussed?
Surely, well, it's not a possibility of having women in and of. It wasn't women in general that was discussed. It was a question we had. I'm thinking of a particular candidate, Mavis Hetherington.
What, in the 60s or 50s?
When was she there? It was before we moved into the our new building.
Oh, do you have Hetherington down there? 1962? No, I don't, but that doesn't mean anything because I didn't write down the... So the building was 62, so...
Is that when the building went up?
Around about there, it was being built.
Right. And it was being built in 62. Let's see, I was in England in 64, and I think that's when it was completed. Because I know that the people moved into the building while I was gone.
Oh.
So it must have been about 64. So she must have come along in the very early 60s, very early 60s. Brogdon was not...
getting women into the departments.
Well, she was a great loss.
You mean you actually, yes.
We hired her, oh yeah.
You did hire her?
Oh yes, oh, and she became a very valued and very important member of the department. Mavis Hetherington came here with her husband, who was a member of the law faculty. She wanted an appointment in the psychology department. I think she had some kind of an appointment in Ed Psych, I believe, at that time. But she did want to join the psychology department. There was interest in her because she had experience in clinical psychology as well as in child development. That's a combination that we had a long time interest in and never really fulfilled. So at any rate, Mavis did have those combination of interests that made her very attractive. Brogdon, I think it's fair to say, had some reluctance to hiring her and expressed negative opinions about that. Despite his stand, however, she was hired. Brogdon maintained some skepticism about her, so that, for example, her raises were not as large in the early years as perhaps they might have been. That's because of our system of how we awarded raises in those days. Everybody got in on the act. Everybody at the executive committee level offered comments and made recommendations. Brogdon wasn't by any means the sole reason for the rather low raises given to Mavis. There was also a widely shared view, and I'm sure that you've encountered this, that since Mavis was married and had a husband with a good job, she didn't need as much of a raise as other people. That was widely accepted. When I was chairman, I took it upon myself to try to get the dean to rectify the situation, to give her larger than average raises. Of course, I valued her, and I think she was a very important person. That's proven to be the case. She has an outstanding reputation in the field of developmental psychology nowadays. But unfortunately, she's gone. Her husband was offered a position at the law school at the University of Virginia, and Mavis went with him.
Oh, so she did leave,
yeah.
Bearing out Brogdon's complaint. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But as I say, we miss her. Miss her for lots of reasons. What was I going to say about the... I was going to say something about the raise situation. Oh, no, about the departmental atmosphere. I think, to me, one of the very interesting aspects of the departmental culture is that the potential for conflict is a very great one. Everybody knows everyone else's salary. It's true throughout the university. Throughout the university.
Yeah, it isn't necessarily that people find out, but they could.
But in the psych department, they do know. That is our tradition, our traditional procedure, is to have every member of the executive committee see the salary recommendations. And in a sense, the executive committee has to vote to give its approval to the salary recommendations. It used to be, when I first arrived, when I first became an associate professor, that the recommendations were made by the entire executive committee, everybody at the tenured level.
You mean all got together in
all
a group?
All got together in a group. But that procedure was changed as the department grew, so that a five-person committee was established, which makes the initial salary recommendations, and these are then voted upon by the entire tenured faculty. Well, because of the fact that the salary recommendations are open for everyone to see, and because of the fact that as a department, everyone is, with just a very few exceptions, everyone's quite active.
Mm-hmm. No, you mean no dead wood? Is that what you're saying?
We have a few, but
that's
a small number.
But that's what you mean
number.
By active.
Yeah, there are a lot of publishers.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the people might realistically say, why not more for me?
Yeah.
But the department has also been discriminating in the sense that it has attempted to make differential salary recommendations. It's been discriminating not only in terms of hiring and retaining, but also in terms of salary recommendations. So discriminations are made, whatever the criteria, discriminations are made, which means, of course, that some people can be bothered, and indeed can be bothered greatly by why they weren't getting as large a raise as Joe Blow. All of this awareness and comparisons does generate tension. As I say, the potential for conflict, it seems to me, is there. What is remarkable is how very little tension there is in the department, given that potential. I've often wondered if the department as a whole isn't a great group of deniers. The tension just doesn't seem to last, or if it's lasted, it doesn't seem to be active. It's just latent or dormant, or whatever would be the right word. It's not that the department is one big happy family. Shouldn't say that. I don't want to give the impression. I don't think there's an awful lot of socializing done, but there is virtually no enmity. People don't engage in vendettas. They're not out to get each other, with the exception of K.U. Smith. He was the only one who was engaged in a vendetta. But aside from that, there's none of that.
Is it separate universes? Is it that kind of thing, where in fact they don't pay much attention to each other?
Well, that's partly it. But I think that this is true of a good many psychology departments around the country, or indeed a good many university departments, where people just go about doing their own things.
Are there groups? Some departments have, for instance, cliques? History. Well, not cliques, no, but by area.
Areas. Well, yes, we have areas. The department, I think, could be characterized as a confederation of areas, and in some ways a confederation of individuals.
And the areas are close to each other. Are they the people in a particular area?
Well, more close. Mm. Closer.
Mm. But not close.
Or more closer than... Yeah. But not really close. Again, we don't collaborate within an area. But we, for example, in my area of social psychology, people in the social psychology area, I guess, have more contact with each other than we have with any people outside the area. This is true both socially as well as professionally. Academically, but we're still not a community or a happy family by any means. We do go about our separate ways and we do our own things. We have, within social psychology, I would say, no conflict whatsoever.
Well, that's an achievement. Is this something that's been true since you came?
Yes.
That the department wasn't closed, but was also not split.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's true. And so the hiring business, I think it's fair to say that there might have been competition among areas, probably still is to a certain extent, for who should get the next slot that would come available. But there were enough people who were unaffected who could pass judgment so that a vote could be taken, decisions could be made on the basis of a majority vote, and that's the way it would end up.
And which way do you go? Do you take the best person available no matter what the slot is, or do you take this by the slot that needs
Well, to we've talked both ways, but I think that we've gone more in terms of the area, the person's area of interest.
Mm.
There were, in the days of the mid-1960s, when the university was rapidly expanding, the area or the type of need was less important.
Yeah.
But everybody was hiring.
Yeah.
We were very slow as a department to hire, come to think of it, even in those days, because of this need for a consensus within the executive committee. We were very, very slow to hire. And as a consequence, well, for one thing, the dean at that time, Dean Epstein, kept on encouraging the psychology department to do more hiring. There was a great deal of student interest. Yet our conservative traditions and our practices were such that we didn't hire as much as we could have. One of the consequences is that the psychology department here in Wisconsin is one of the smallest departments in the Big Ten. So
it is. It certainly seems a small department.
Yeah, that was especially true in the days when we had more psychology, more majors in our department
than anybody else.
We just didn't do as much hiring as we should have. And not only did we were we slow to hire, we did let people go.
You mean because you couldn't keep them?
No.
Or you mean because you let them because they weren't of high enough quality?
Well, yes, they didn't meet our criteria.
Yeah. Yes, there seem one notices a great many people in, and then their names aren't there
yeah,
the next time.
Yeah, right.
Well, what on earth was the cause of the reorganization in 1965?
Of what?
After Archer was, I guess he just
right,
got me chairman.
You do know a lot.
Yes, well, I looked at the papers. They divided into 14 committees, and everything was to be decided by...
I don't know about the 14 committees.
Oh, Arch was writing you about it. You were in England.
Oh, yes.
And he was very
My
disturbed
goodness.
About it.
Are all of those papers retained?
Yes, yes.
You know what you might do sometime? It would be interesting to have you come to a department meeting and tell your perception of the history of the psychology. Would you like to do that?
It would be based on something that they would all know. Why? Is that
No,
is
nobody
that
would
unusual?
Know that. What?
Is it,
I'm one of the few people around who knows about these things.
Hmm.
Would you have any interest in doing that?
I don't feel I know enough. I mean, I...
You know more than anybody else. I'll make you sing for your supper.
That's an interesting thought. It would certainly force me to put down in writing all these bits of notes I have.
Well, let me explore this and then I'll try it out with you. May I?
I don't know how effective I'd be. Maybe I could write it up. Maybe I could tell you and you could do it.
No, I find this fascinating that you're aware of all of that. I didn't realize that the papers were there.
They are, and anybody could look through them.
Yeah.
But it is, one sees this sudden loss by the chairman of any kind of power. And usually a department, when it does that, is, you want to go now. Well, let's...
No, let me tell you about Archer, and then I'll quit, because I find this is fascinating. This is, he's one of the, you know what you're doing is giving me an opportunity to gossip.
All right, maybe that's what oral history in the university is.
I find the whole Archer business as very interesting. It says a lot about the way universities in general operate, not only Wisconsin, but all sorts of universities.
Yeah.
I find him, he's a fascinating man. I said that Brogdon was narrow and rigid. Brogdon is a piker in comparison to Jim Archer.
Well, that's the answer to my question then, isn't it? Why they took the power away from the chairman?
The chairman never really had much power
oh.
in the system. Never really had much power, but... I remember something vaguely about these subcommittees, but it was a resistance, a reaction against Archer. Archer was a man who was very, very highly organized. He was great in doing paperwork, exceedingly highly motivated to get everything down, to get everything neat, to have everything orderly. He was an extraordinary committee person because he did his homework, he had all the facts, he could marshal his views in a very articulate manner. And so when he was chairman at the time that we moved into the psychology building, as I understand, and the move, I'm sure, was facilitated by his great organizing ability and interest. But in contrast to Brogdon, he was very intolerant of differences. As I said, that Brogdon was, people often disagreed with him. But he wouldn't take it personally. He was frequently, almost always outvoted.
Mm-hmm.
He would not take it personally.
Yeah.
He just kept on expressing his views and then would live with the differences. Especially as the department got larger and as new people came in. He was just outvoted and he would persist in his point of view, but never become personal,
yeah.
never become vindictive. That wasn't true for Archer. Archer had very strong views and felt that anybody who disagreed with him, there was something wrong with that person. And he took a lot of it personally. So that for example, he was very. We have a coffee room, a faculty lounge. Jim and his wife decided that the faculty weren't keeping the room neat enough, and so on a couple of occasions they came into the lounge, either in the morning or at night, and cleaned up.
That's an absolutely new one.
Not because they wanted to be nice to the department, but I think they were essentially hoping to shame the department into doing better, to be neater, to be more orderly.
That's fascinating.
He had... very strict and very authoritarian views, and as I say, became intolerant of those who disagreed with him. What you're referring to is there was an experiment, a teaching experiment, in which that Jim organized to have the introductory psychology course taught over closed circuit television on videotape.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I guess there was a difference of opinion as to how the teaching credit could be allocated for that course and who was the possessor of the videotape and so forth. The course was supposed to be divided, not one person, but people from different areas would give their lectures, that's in the different fields. And the question of how the teaching credit should be allocated among all of the people who contributed to that videotape course. But anyway, there are all sorts of difficulties that I've forgotten surrounding this whole videotape course, and I think that was one of the things that contributed to the enmity. But and I've forgotten what the details were. I know that Archer was continually sending out memos expressing his different opinions, lecturing the department, chastising the faculty. And finally it exploded. I think there was a rebellion against his arbitrariness, his high-handedness, and he resigned. But and one of the things that I find interesting is just at about that time, you want to move over?
Oh, it's this window now. I see. Put it down.
Doesn't bother me. I find this is a very interesting point about how universities operate. Here he was, a man who had been, if you will, a total failure as a department chair. At just that time when he was, when he and the department were at each other's throats or very unfriendly to each other, he was offered the job as graduate dean at the University of Colorado. The people at Colorado not once asked us at Wisconsin what we thought of, of Jim, what kind of a chairman he had been, what kind of a faculty member he had been. They thought they were winners in a great coup. They had lured this highly desirable person away from Wisconsin. Well, what happened was that within a very short time, he was a great failure at Colorado. He continued his authoritarian ways, evidently antagonized a fair number of junior level people at the University of Colorado because he had a good graduate dean there, apparently has a good deal of power. And he treated, apparently, from the stories, he treated a lot of people in a very high-handed, arbitrary fashion there, too. So there was a rebellion against him there. Apparently, I think he was relieved of that position. Well, shortly after that, he left the position of graduate dean to become an academic vice president at a university on the East Coast.
What university?
I think it was Rhode Island.
Oh, for him. And they didn't ask Colorado.
And apparently they didn't ask him either. That's the thing that I find very interesting.
Yes, because usually these dean searches are accompanied by all sorts of letters from...
Well, they didn't inquire all sorts of the information. You see, he was so good as a committee person.
Yeah.
And seemed to be so highly organized that they never inquired into things about his personal relationships.
Well, that's what you would think looking at the correspondence. I mean, there's a great deal of it, and it looks well thought out. And
yeah.
But then you wonder why everything was split into 14 committees. Then, of course, that's the answer.
Well, that was, I guess, just an attempt to take whatever power he had away from
him. So presumably the whole system broke up as soon as the new chairman.
Oh, yeah. We don't have anything like that. Nothing like that.
It would be awful. You could imagine in a department everybody having to go to committee.
I think that must have been devised by Brogdon and Grant, that kind of thing. It sounds to me as if it might have been Brogdon's Machiavellian.